Portions of the day's programming are reproduced by means of electrical transcriptions or tape recording.
This is Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat.
Game over! Notre Dame knocks off number one!
Tell them what time it is.
We're going to keep getting back here. I'm sorry if you don't like it, and we're going to put ourselves back in this position again.
Pretty good.
With Sean Stiers.
Notre Dame is the national champion!
Fisher's going to keep it himself. Slips past a tackler and dives with one hand to the end zone. Touchdown, Mishawaka.
On Sports Radio 960 AM, WSBT.
The Bears are what we thought they were.
They are who we thought they were. And we let them off the hook.
He's running down the middle by the 50. He's at the 30. He's bare-chested and banging his chest. They're chasing him. They're not going to get him.
And now your host, Sean Stiers.
How we doing today, Wednesday, rolling on through this week as we get closer to another Notre Dame football game. This one, of course, on the road when the Fighting Irish head to Virginia Tech this Saturday night. You'll get all the action right here, all the coverage on Sports Radio 960 AM WSBT, Virginia Tech and Notre Dame. 7:30 kickoff. Our coverage starts at 1 o'clock with a replay of the Brian Kelly Show. From 2 until 4, it's the Game Day Show with Tim Grau, Vince D'Addario, and guests. 4 to 6:30, Budweiser's Game Day Sports Beat with Darren Pritchett and I. 6:30, Notre Dame Radio Network's Tailgate Show. 7:30, the game kicks off. And then after the show, the Notre Dame Football Post Game Show with Evan Sharpley and I. So that is coming up this Saturday here on Sports Radio 960 AM WSBT. Hear from Brian Kelly here. Some comments from him in just a few minutes. Wanted to start with Jalen Smith, cut by the Dallas Cowboys officially this afternoon. The news broke last night. Head-scratching part for a lot of people is they have to eat $7.2 million on his contract this year on the salary cap. The bigger part of this is, though, they're also going to be off the hook for potentially $9.6 million in guaranteed money next year. If he were to be injured at any point this year and not be able to play or whatever next year, they'd be on the hook for $9.6 million guaranteed. And, you know, I know it's still hard for a lot of Notre Dame people, you know, to kind of grasp. As someone who covered Smith's career here at Notre Dame and as someone who's also seen every snap that he's played for the Cowboys, watching those games in his NFL career, and, you know, disclaimer, you know, if you listen to the show, you know I'm a Cowboys fan, but, you know, so I have seen all of his games as a Dallas Cowboy, so I have some pretty in-depth perspective of where Jalen Smith, the player, is right now. He had, of course, we all know, the gruesome knee injury in his last game for Notre Dame at the Fiesta Bowl after the 2015 season, or at the end of the 2015 season. So instead of being drafted at or near the top of the 2016 draft, he goes in the second round to Dallas when Jerry Jones threw him a little bit of a life raft there. It was still a huge gamble for Jones to draft him there because Dallas had a lot of immediate needs on defense. There was no guarantee that Jalen Smith was ever going to be able to play again at that point. But he did. He comes back in 2017. Solid, not spectacular, and, you know, what do you expect? There was still a noticeable gait in his stride from that drop foot that he had due to the nerve damage in his knee and leg. But then 2018, he was great. Played lights out middle linebacker for the Cowboys, and it earns him a $65 million contract. But that's kind of where the storybook part of the journey ends for Jalen Smith, or at least where it veers off into the dark, dark woods, because his play starts to decline immediately after he gets that contract in 2019, and it has declined even more since then, even more last year. 2019, I was willing to kind of write it off to an extent because, one, he had just come off a Pro Bowl year. Again, he was great in 2018, and he had a ton of tackles, but Dallas had injuries around him. Leighton Vander Esch missed a good chunk of that year, the other linebacker they drafted in the first round, and their safeties were injured as well. So there were a lot more responsibilities that were getting heaped on Jalen Smith, both in run support and pass coverage. So, again, I was kind of willing to write off 2019, but then even more downhill last year. Smith was late on reads, slow to react after the snap of the football, late getting to the ball. Now, in his defense, the Dallas defense was historically bad last year. They end up firing Mike Nolan, the defensive coordinator, after just one season coming in with Mike McCarthy. But with questions about Smith, Dallas goes out this past offseason. They draft Micah Parsons in the first round out of Penn State. They brought in Keanu Neal, who played with their new defensive coordinator, Dan Quinn, in Atlanta when he was the head coach there. They drafted another linebacker, Jabril Cox, out of LSU. They took him in the fourth round. And it felt like going into the season, Smith would be playing for his future in Dallas. And that's what it ended up being. And, you know, now I know being critical of Smith is a slippery slope, especially with people who are both Notre Dame and Cowboys fans, because it's almost like he's like their brother or their son or something. Or like sports parents, you know, the ones standing behind the backstop, they critique every pitch, you know, that their kid throws, or they sit in the stands and want to give instructions on every play, you know, but it's their kid, so they can be hard on him, but that dumb coach of his better not say anything about him. It's kind of like that, you know. But Jalen Smith, the bottom line for him, he no longer makes impact tackles. You know, like the big hits coming downhill hard toward the line of scrimmage, the kind that you saw Jeremiah Owusu-Koramoah make last year, the kind that Smith was making at Notre Dame, for that matter, the kind J.D. Bertrand makes this year, those kind of tackles. Those kind of guys making those plays at, near, or behind the line of scrimmage. They're making tackles on run plays that put teams in 2nd and 8, 3rd and 10, those kind of plays, because they're creating havoc, making tackles for loss. Owusu-Koramoah had 11 tackles for loss in 12 games last year for Notre Dame. Bertrand already has 4.5 this year. Jalen Smith has no tackles for loss this season, playing middle linebacker. He's averaged 4 tackles for loss a season the last 4 years. He's hesitant both at and after the snap of the football. His reads are late. You see him chopping his feet, you know, right after the snap of the football, because you see that he's trying to figure out where he's supposed to be. And for whatever reason, between whatever lingering injury he has with that drop foot and the fact that he just doesn't look like he knows where he's supposed to be, he still makes tackles. In fact, he has a lot. But again, they're typically 5 to 6 yards downfield. He's chasing the play. And I've heard defenders say this. Defenders of his say this. Well, he's improved. Okay, true. He has made some improvement this year. But that's also... he's improved is a relative term. It's like saying, well, old Joe's lost some weight. Okay, well, how much weight? Because there's a lot of room between 1 pound and 50 pounds. Jalen Smith was graded in the bottom 5% of inside linebackers last year. So there was a lot of room for improvement. So he may have improved, but he hasn't improved enough. He runs hard to the ball. He gets himself in on a lot of tackles at the end of the play. But he's actually, like the hardcore Dallas fans, they go after him hard. And again, I know that's hard, you know, for people here to sort of comprehend, especially when you look at the fact that he's only 3 years removed from playing in the Pro Bowl. But, and like the people who have no sentimental Notre Dame connections to him down there around Dallas, I mean, they have been really, really hard on him. Like, and if you read any of the coverage from Dallas reporters about him getting cut today, they're only mentioning the financials and that kind of impact. They're not talking about his declining play, because they've been talking about it for 2 years. It has been an ongoing conversation in the media, on sports radio, in the papers, online, all that different stuff. So to them, it's just a given at this point. They already know that. Jalen Smith is absolutely a great person. He has overcome a ton just to get to where he is right now. But as former Cowboy quarterback Tony Romo said at the end of his career, football's a meritocracy. You get what you earn. And unfortunately, Jalen Smith's play, combined with other guys who are better than him on the roster right now, they no longer merit the Dallas Cowboys keeping him. So hopefully he finds a home with someone else. Again, you know, he's guaranteed $7.2 million this year, so he'll be all right for the short term. I know he does a lot with charities and things like that. Hopefully it is not too long before Jalen Smith finds a new place that he can call home in the NFL, and hopefully he does well at it as well. But again, he's done a ton just to get to where he is right now. All right, some comments from Brian Kelly, the Fighting Irish head football coach. Notre Dame, of course, coming off its first loss of the season to Cincinnati Saturday. And not only is it their first loss of the season, it's their first regular season loss in just short of two calendar years. Prior to losing to Cincinnati Saturday, Notre Dame's last regular season loss was at Michigan in 2019. That was the last time they lost in the regular season. Of course, the last time they lost at home was 4 years ago to Georgia. So how has Brian Kelly's team handled the loss this week?
Yeah, certainly they were disappointed yesterday. They came in for a meal yesterday. We don't have interaction with them. It's their day off. But, you know, you could sense that they were disappointed, certainly, in the loss. And, you know, it's similar to what I talked about. You know, I think they sting more when you beat yourself. You know, I don't want to take anything away from Cincinnati. But, you know, they sting more when you beat yourself. And we just really need to coach better and put our kids in better position to succeed. And our players need to play better. So this is all in on this. You know, this is if there were no players in the building, you'd feel the same way, because I think the coaches feel that sting as well.
Yeah, and I just wonder, and I just thought about this in the last couple of days. I just wonder how much more personal sting there is for Brian Kelly in all this, because not only is it first regular season loss in almost 2 years, first home loss in 4 years, but there was a personal connection to that game. It was, he's just coming off passing Newt Rockne as the program's all-time winningest head coach. He comes home and he gets booed by people wearing red in his own stadium at Notre Dame Stadium when they play the tribute video to him breaking Newt Rockne's record. All these Cincinnati fans are booing him and letting him have it, and then they end up losing that game as well, playing three quarterbacks in the process. How difficult is this loss to get over, though?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, first of all, is it you have to address, you know, why you fell short, right? And so, you know, pointing out, you know, where did we fall short in our preparation? You know, where did we fall short in our process? You know, that's where we start. And then once we identify that, we close the book and we move on, and we trust our process and go back to it and commit to it. And if we do that, we'll be fine.
So trust the process, back to the process. And you know, that's something that kind of became, along with traits, kind of one of the catchphrase / cliches a few years back. Don't hear as much about that, but their process has been pretty good. They have rattled off a ton of wins over the last few years. Again, when you haven't lost a regular season game in nearly two calendar years, that is saying something. But now you lose this game, and it's a close game. It's obviously a game you felt like you should have won, if not for the turnovers especially. And you can throw in the quarterback situation. That's fair game, especially when you're playing three quarterbacks. One guy plays the first half, one guy plays the second half, the other guy plays parts of both halves, and that's part of it. And the third guy commits a turnover, the first guy commits a turnover, a guy who just took a kickoff to the house the week before commits a big turnover as well. So they gave Cincinnati some points, but now you're going on the road, and obviously you need to be able to rebound. But do you kind of have to resist coaching differently after this loss?
Yeah, it's kind of what I just said, right? We're gonna talk about where we fell short. We're gonna address it straightforwardly relative to what our total preparation looks like, and our total preparation is about the physical, the technical, the tactical, and the mental. Where do we fall short in those areas? As coaches and players, I've made that pretty clear. And then we'll apply our traits to that, and then we'll move on from there. We'll close the book, and we'll go, all right, let's stick to our process. Let's trust it. It works. Let's get back to work, and let's get ready for Virginia Tech.
There we go. Process, traits, get back to work, on to Virginia Tech. It's on to Cincinnati. That's what it's – I guess, well, you can't really say that this week, but that's the Belichick on to Cincinnati, which – again, you apply it this week, or, you know, means something a little bit different, saying it now. But we're going to see a quarterback. That much we know. At least one quarterback. We saw three last week. Again, we saw Jack Cohn start once again. We saw Drew Pine come in relief, and this is his first real relief appearance, performance-based relief appearance, because he came in due to injury against Wisconsin the previous game. But then we didn't see Tyler Buchner for two games. We saw Tyler Buchner back this week, and you can argue, I think there's a really strong case that they were probably better off just staying away from that, at least last week, based on what they tried to have Tyler Buchner do. But is Brian Kelly going to change things up this week? He said Monday, the depth chart still said Jack Cohn at the top of the depth chart. That's because they released the depth chart before the press conference at noon. And he said that they hadn't talked to the parties concerned, the two guys, maybe the third as well. They hadn't talked to the quarterback room anyway about who the starter was going to be. Like, if you're going to read into that, just the fact that you have to have that conversation, maybe that leads you to believe that a change is coming. But what went into the decision with whoever is going to be the starting quarterback this week?
Who graded out well, who played well. Nobody was perfect, as we know. At the quarterback position, there was mistakes made by all three. But I think at the end of the day, who gives you the best chance to win? This is still about winning football games. We feel like we've got a team that can win the rest of their games. And we want to be able to put the quarterback out there that we believe gives us the chance to do that.
Yeah, so again, nothing real earth-shattering there from him on that. The quarterback who gives them the best chance to win, I mean, theoretically, that's regardless of position, that's who you're playing every week, right? The guy at each position is the starter who gives you the best chance to win. And now maybe based on scheme of the other team, offense or defense, it's one guy over another. But I think a lot of people, if you did a poll, most people would have said, well, Drew Pine would have given you the best chance to win last week. As it turned out, that definitely seemed to be the case. He at least has more mobility than Jack Cohn. He's getting the ball out quicker than Jack Cohn. There's still some things that if Jack Cohn was the Jack Cohn that we saw against Florida State in the opener, I think that there is a strong case for Jack Cohn still, because he was under a lot of pressure in that game, got sacked a lot of times in that game, but he's been sacked time after time after time again this year, and I think that that has affected him between the ears in different ways, to where he is holding on to the ball too long at times. Sometimes he gets himself into trouble in the pocket that he doesn't need to, just because it looks like his clock is sped up. And, so a lot of different things. But I think a lot of people would tell you that they felt like Drew Pine was the guy to go with last week. But Brian Kelly is not announcing his quarterback publicly this week. At least that's the last word that we got. So is there a competitive advantage in doing so?
I don't know that I'm thinking in that term, Angela. I think I'm more interested in what we do more than I'm trying to hide something from Virginia Tech. But they've seen all three play. They're pretty smart. They can figure it out. So this is really not about trying to gain a competitive advantage. It's more is that I just want to focus on talking to our kids today and getting them moving and start the process that way.
All right. So there you go. Not necessarily a competitive advantage. And, I mean, if you're Virginia Tech, you've got to prepare for all three anyway, because all three of them just played last week. So you'd be foolish not to prepare for all three. We're going to take a timeout when we come back. Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat continues with Brian Driscoll from IrishBreakdown.com. We'll continue with more Notre Dame conversation, including the offensive line. We will get into that a little bit more. Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat is brought to you by Budweiser, the king of beers, locally distributed by United Beverage Company of South Bend. Football fans, this Bud's for you. The Food Bank of Northern Indiana. Hunger's a story we can end. Find out how at feedindiana.org. Tim Growl State Farm Insurance. You need life insurance today. Tomorrow will be too late. Protect your family by calling Tim at 232-9981. By Midland Engineering Company, completing their first century of quality roofing experience. The Mishawaka Education Foundation, granting a better future. Barnaby's of Mishawaka and Granger, serving Michiana's most favorite pizza for both dine-in and carry-out. Fisher's Barbecue and Catering, East McKinley in Mishawaka. Drive-thru open Tuesday through Saturday. Just look for the smoke. South Bend Orthopedics, team physicians for the University of Notre Dame since 1949. Wings Etc. Grill and Pub with 14 Michiana area locations. Four Winds Casino, your entertainment escape. Mimo's Pizza on Edison in Mishawaka. And Legacy Heating and Air. Brian Driscoll next when Budweiser's weekday sports beat continues on Sports Radio 960 WSBT. Rolling on with Budweiser's weekday sports beat. Glad to have you with us on this Wednesday. It's 5:30. That means Brian Driscoll time. How are you today?
I'm doing great.
Glad to have you as always. Talk a little Notre Dame football. We've got Notre Dame and Virginia Tech. 7:30 kickoff this Saturday night here on Sports Radio 960 WSBT. And we were just talking a little bit off the air. What do you think about this whole, you know, game of what do you call it? Like, you know, like the shell things, you know, like where you're moving around. The media shows up last night thinking that they're going to get some four specific guys to interview, and then it turns out it's Chris Tyree and four walk-ons out there at the last minute.
I viewed it as incredibly unprofessional and just another example of just how little Notre Dame values the media or values. They don't have to value us, but at least show a level of respect, professional respect. You know, for example, you get people leaving their families and driving to these events. It wasn't like it was a Zoom thing where we were all on Zoom. You had people, I had one of my employees driving over an hour each way to be there for this. And he's got story ideas and content ideas, you know, so he can make money to feed his family. And they tried out for walk-ons, and that's not a shot at the walk-ons. I guarantee you, there's some really interesting stories.
Oh, absolutely.
Amongst those four young men. But the media people had 30 seconds to prepare for who these people are going to be. And it was unfair to those kids, and it's like they're being used as pawns to kind of get, you know, I feel like to take a shot at the media for the fact that he was actually, for the first time all season, asked some difficult questions, and people like myself, you know, wrote some very critical articles of the manner in which Notre Dame once again got embarrassed in a game of top 10 opponents, and you know, it just was just a really unprofessional, in my opinion, thing to do. That you know, look, if you want to do something like that, there's a right way to go about it, especially since we were given a list of names of who was going to be there. People are putting in work and spending time on formulating out story ideas and other such things. And then all of a sudden, just like that, with no warning, you change it. It's just very unprofessional, in my opinion.
Brian, there's something that, you know, I know you haven't really talked a lot about publicly, but you referenced it Monday when you were here with me, and we've talked a little bit about it before, and I know you've talked a little bit more about it on your site here in the last couple of days. And another outlet reported on it, and then you kind of got the go-ahead, I think, from some of your sources to say, yeah, you know, it's okay if you talk about it. So Chris Watt, I'll kind of set it up, and I'm going to let you, you know, kind of take it. Chris Watt, who played on Notre Dame's 2012 team. He was a guard on that team that, you know, played in the BCS championship game. Mm-hmm. He was a grad assistant working with Notre Dame's offensive line last year, his first year back at Notre Dame. So he played at Notre Dame for Harry Hiestand, of course. Notre Dame's offensive line made a lot of improvement last year. And so it turns out the Watt connection was not a coincidence to that improvement. So I'll kind of let you, you know, fill in as much detail as you want to go with from there. I found it just really interesting to, you know, to see just some of the details behind all this. What exactly was going on behind the scenes that we didn't know?
Well, I've hinted for over a year on our podcast, Sean, which I know you've heard me say several times, and I've hinted even on this show at times that, you know, the Harry Hiestand DNA was much more ingrained in that team last year than people realized. And a lot of that was, if you're Harry Hiestand and you're retired, basically, and one of your former players who's trying to get into coaching comes to Notre Dame, same city you live in, are you not going to do everything possible to try to help him be successful? That's number one. So there was a lot of interaction between Coach Hiestand and Chris Watt, from what I'm told from sources, about helping him prepare for practices and film and game planning and things along those lines. I'm also told that Chris Watt had a much heavier influence on being a grad assistant as far from a coaching standpoint than your normal GA, which is not uncommon under Brian Kelly's tenure. Remember, in 2017, Notre Dame's quarterback's coach was a graduate assistant. His name was Tommy Reese, mm-hmm. right? He was a GA in 2017 because it was the year before they expanded to 10 assistant coaches. They knew they were going to expand, so they brought him in as a GA. And so Coach Watt had a very heavy influence. And that came after, really, the Notre Dame players for over a year trying to, from what I was told by multiple sources, politic Brian Kelly to bring him in 2019. After the 2018 season, I was told that some players went to Coach Kelly and asked that they bring in Coach Watt to help Coach Quinn. They like Coach Quinn. They respect Coach Quinn, but they felt he needed some assistance. And Coach Kelly rebuffed it, from what I was told by my sources. And then a year later, they went to him again. And this time, Coach Kelly said, okay, let's do it. And from what I'm told, Coach Quinn was very good with Chris Watt, letting him be involved. It was a good relationship, from what I'm told. But Chris Watt was not your normal GA. You know, one of the criticisms I've heard about Coach Quinn going back to 2018 is that he doesn't really do a lot of game film of opponents with the players. And so a lot of the complaint in 18 and 19 was is they felt unprepared for what was happening on Saturdays. You remember going back to 2018 against Ball State and Vanderbilt and Pitt and other teams like that. And so those seasons, you know, you had Alex Bars trying to take an extra leadership role and making sure they were watching opponent film. In 2019, that was Robert Hainsey. And then last year was Chris Watt. And, you know, it's not a surprise that the anomaly of the 4 years of the Jeff Quinn era from a performance and production from the offensive line happened to be the season in which Chris Watt was much more heavily involved than your typical GA and was part of the program. And he's gone, and you had an offensive line that had four Harry Hiestand recruits that Coach Hiestand coached for at least 1 year, still had a relationship with, and you had probably the second best line of the last decade. They're gone. There's only one Harry Hiestand recruit left on campus of someone who he recruited and coached for at least a year. That's Josh Lugg. And all of a sudden, a group filled with Jeff Quinn players who've only been coached by Jeff Quinn looks unprepared every Saturday for what teams are doing at them. And that all has fit, and I've been talking about this for a couple of years, it all fits with exactly what we see. They don't know how to pick up stunts. Teams are bringing corner fires every week that work every time. Teams are doing things in Notre Dame on a week-to-week basis that they look unprepared to handle, despite the fact it's relatively basic stuff. It is an unprepared football team, and it absolutely fits with what we saw in 2019, what we saw in 2018. It's just that the talent level this year isn't as good as those two teams, in my opinion.
I don't – what you said about he doesn't like to, you know, do a lot of game film with the players, you know, like scouting the opponent. So what – you know, I realize there's whatever goes on the practice field, but that just seems shocking to me that a position coach at Notre Dame, you know, you're not at McNeese State. It's right. How can that happen?
I coached at the D3 and 1AA level, Sean, and I guarantee you we watched game film with our players. So
right.
It is,
and I'm not. I'm just baffled. I guess is what
I'm
saying.
And I am too. And part of me to this day still doubts it. And if the sources I had for that weren't so direct and so close to the program and no longer around, I don't know how else I can explain this, I wouldn't have believed it. But it was multiple sources that are very, very, very close to the situation that told me the same story over and over and over again. And when you hear the same story kind of being repeated by multiple people, often without me asking, it, you know, because I was someone who was a bit critical of the Coach Quinn hire, so I think they knew that there was a someone who would actually listen to what they were saying and the criticism that they were saying. A lot of times those people reaching out to me, like, you don't even know the half of it, right? And so what it would do is like, hey, look, I'm watching the game film as the coach. I'm drawing up the cards. We're going over these things in practice, and then we're going to watch the practice film together so that way I can focus on your technique against these looks. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the explanation for it. I just don't think that works because I need to see how the other team does it. I need to see the different things they do. I need to see, you know, what kind of techniques this player is using and how does he execute these stunts that a scout team guy is not going to be able to replicate. Or if you're going up against your first team defense, they can't replicate. You need to have that preparation of the context of the game, watching third down film. Hey, what's the third and short film? What's the, I mean, we used to get first down film, backed up film, red zone film, first and second and short film, third and short film, third and medium film, you know, third and long film, you know, just cover three film, cover two. I mean, you do all these things that you would do. And this is for D3 kids. I mean, the more film, the better, as long as there's a structure in which they know how to work through it and understand it. So it's always been kind of mind-boggling to me. I really can't come up with a good reason why it's that way. I still, to this day, find I still have some skepticism about it, but I've never had anyone tell me otherwise that was a, that was directly related to the situation.
Brian Driscoll with us from IrishBreakdown.com. What about the practice field itself? Because one thing about Harry Hiestand, and Mike Elko is like this as well, like, fundamentals, details, mm-hmm. like they would do things over and over and over again on the field, not just until they got it right, but until they did it right every time. Small movements, you know, lead to mm-hmm. to bigger things kind of thing. Is there a disparity on the practice field, you know, that we're talking about as well that you know of?
From what I'm told, yes. Obviously, we can't be at practice,
right.
So I can't tell you that.
And that's
firsthand.
What I'm talking about, what you've been
right.
told by, yeah.
And Clark Lee was that way too. I mean, Clark Lee was very much a, you line up right here and you take this step and, you know, and
right.
And those kind of things. And look, to me, that's how a college coach has to be. And I think this was Charlie Weiss's failure. You know, in 2005 and 2006, Charlie Weiss inherited a very veteran team that had been taught how to line up, how to get in your stance, how to come out of your stance, how to play. And this, you had the scheme and it's phenomenal. And then all of a sudden those guys all leave and it's a roster's filled with his recruits who haven't been taught how to do those things. And all of a sudden, a team that goes, what was it, 19-6 in 2 years and is a top 10 team back-to-back years becomes a disaster of a program over the next 3 years. And, you know, that's something Harry Hiestand was just incredibly focused on, fundamentals, how to play, how to play, how to play. And his thought was, if I teach you how to play and I teach you the right footwork and I teach you understand the basic foundational principles of a zone offense, it really doesn't, and this is true. I mean, I've coached in zone offenses and this is 100% true. If you understand what a zone blocking scheme is and you understand the principles and the rules and the footwork in which you handle all these different things, then it doesn't really matter if they throw a bunch of new looks at us, because we can adjust that because we understand the foundational principles and we know how to play the game. It's about coming off hard, coming
sure.
off low, win the leverage battle, use your hands, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And what I have been told is that the current situation is much more scheme-oriented. And it's more focused on, hey, here's our scheme and these type of things. And that's all fine and dandy. But if you don't know how to, you know, play the game from a fundamentally sound nature, then you're going to have those problems. I mean, you look at Josh Lugg, for example. Go watch his 2019 film and then compare it to now. Go watch Kane Madden at Marshall and compare it to now. And you're seeing the further we get away from the Harry Hiestand era, the less and less and less fundamentally sound these players are. And as now that the Hiestand DNA has been completely removed from the offensive line, we're seeing not just a drop off, which was expected, but just a complete bottoming out.
Brian Driscoll from IrishBreakdown.com. Just, you know, I think there's a case for every game being must win, but with all this stuff going on coming out of Cincinnati last week, does this feel like must win this week at Virginia Tech?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, look, the frustrating thing is that we're talking about this stuff and not a 4-1 football team that's ranked in the top 15 and still has an outside shot at the playoff. And I'm not frustrated by the fact that we're talking about it. I'm frustrated by the fact that we have to talk about it. That's the frustration, because this was all correctable. These are all self-inflicted wounds. And you've got to change course immediately, because if you lose this game to Virginia Tech, now all of a sudden you're 4-2. Hopefully you stay in the top 25, but you're getting ready to get into the part of your schedule where you're now going to start playing teams that can score. Teams where, as we saw with Cincinnati, your defense can hold them to 19 points below their season scoring average and you still lose by 11.
Yeah.
You know, so if you can't start showing some ability to reverse course and fix this problem, then you're going to lose a lot more games, because we're in a scenario now, Sean, where if the Notre Dame defense doesn't play great football, Notre Dame is either going to barely beat a bad team or they're going to lose to a good team. That's been the story of the 2021 season so far. Mm-hmm. When the Notre Dame defense plays great, they're going to win, and they can win convincingly, Purdue and Wisconsin. If they don't play great, then they're going to either lose or barely beat a Toledo or a Florida State. that's a tremendous burden to put on any unit.
Right.
And but that's where the Notre Dame defense is right now.
And this game this week is going to be a matchup of two good defenses. Neither team runs the ball, you know, exceptionally well. You know, Notre Dame's issues are well documented. Virginia Tech, not a whole lot better. So ultimately, the offense, the winner of this game, their offense needs, you know, is going to have to do what in this game, do you think?
Capitalize on opportunities provided to them by the defense. I'll say one thing that the Notre Dame offense has been really good at all year is when the defense forces a turnover and gets them the ball, they capitalize.
Right.
I mean, we saw that on Saturday where, you know, Notre Dame's getting work. The offense hasn't really threatened to score since the opening drive. Defense strip sack returns it back. Yeah, and Notre Dame offense didn't go down and get a field goal. They punched that sucker right into the end zone, and they've done that a lot this year. You know, they did it against Wisconsin. I think they got, what, two touchdowns and a field goal, right? Or it was a touchdown and two field goals. They've really done that all season. If the defense gives them a short field, they're going to capitalize and go put points on the board. So I think it's the team that protects the ball the best. The team that takes advantages of what the defense does is going to win. But at the end of the day, Notre Dame is still the better football team. And Vince made a great point in our show today. He said, you know, we do a stacking up where we kind of give advantages run game, pass game, and overall scoring of the offense versus the defense. And we gave Virginia Tech every edge with their defense. We gave Notre Dame every edge in their defense. And the point that Vince made says, we're doing that because of how Notre Dame is playing on offense. Notre Dame still has better players than Virginia Tech. So if Notre Dame brings their A game on offense, they're going to dominate. If Virginia Tech brings their A game on offense, but Notre Dame also brings their A game on defense, Notre Dame's still going to dominate that matchup. And that's the difference. And so for Notre Dame, it's going to come down to play competent football up front. I mean, that's really it. If they play competent football up front, Notre Dame will score and score a decent amount against this Virginia Tech team and start to finally get some momentum heading into the bye week with some nice momentum. That is an absolute must. They have to start building up some confidence over these next couple weeks.
All right, Brian Driscoll, give us the details. What else can folks find right now at irishbreakdown.com?
Well, there's been a lot of the discussion about the Heistand versus the Quinn Aaron, things like that. So I have a breakdown right now on our midweek musings on the front page of our site where I kind of compare the two eras and the circumstances in which each coach stepped into the mix and then the success they had and really dive into some numbers. So if you like to nerd out on football stats like I do and things like that, then you're going to really like to read that. And then, of course, we're going to have our breakdowns. I got a stacking up article today, A Time to Shine, which is a prediction of or breakdown of Notre Dame players and a coach that have to step up and really be at their best if Notre Dame's going to win this weekend. And, of course, on Friday we'll have our game predictions.
Excellent. Brian Driscoll, irishbreakdown.com. Great stuff as always. I will talk to you next Monday.
Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely, Brian Driscoll. Take a timeout. When we come back, my five question of the day, five things to know about Virginia Tech ahead of Saturday's game. That's next on Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat.
This is the My Five Question of the Day.
Can you dig it?
On Sports Radio 960 AM WSBT.
Today's My Five Question of the Day, five things to know ahead of the Notre Dame-Virginia Tech game, five things to know about the Hokies. Number five, Saturday's game will be the fourth all-time meeting between Notre Dame and Virginia Tech. They've all come since 2016 when the Hokies beat the Irish at Notre Dame Stadium. The Irish have won the last two, and the two teams are not scheduled to play again until 2027 after this Saturday. Number four, Virginia Tech is 31-1 under sixth-year head coach Justin Fuente when they hold opponents to 21 points or fewer. They've won 28 straight games when they've allowed 17 or fewer points, while Notre Dame has won just one of its last 11 games when the Irish score 17 or fewer. Number three, Hokie wide receiver Tavion Robinson is known as Sweet Feet, but he's also currently the best punt returner in the ACC. His 15 yards per punt return is helped by a 60-yard touchdown for a 60-yard touchdown punt return against Richmond. He ranks fourth among Power 5 punt returners currently. Number two, Virginia Tech is the least penalized team in the Football Bowl subdivision. Hokies have committed just 15 penalties through four games, and their 136 penalty yards is second to Louisiana Monroe. Now, there is a little bit of an asterisk with that since they had a bye last week. So they've got one fewer game than a lot of people like Notre Dame. But the number one thing, the Hokies have one of the best scoring defenses in the nation. They're allowing just 15.3 points a game, which ranks 11th in the nation. Also 7th among Power 5 teams this season. And again, that number skewed a little bit because they gave up a total of 24 points to FCS teams, Richmond and Middle Tennessee. They also limited North Carolina to just 10 points in their season opening win over the Tar Heels. So that is today's My 5 question of the day. 5 things to know about Virginia Tech ahead of Saturday's game in Blacksburg against the Fighting Irish. That is a 7:30 kickoff Saturday night, and it's going to be televised on the ACC Network. So if you don't get the ACC Network, well, you can listen right here on Sports Radio 960 AM WSBT. If you want to watch it, though, you better find some place if you don't get ACC Network. But our coverage of that game, our game day coverage, starts at 1 o'clock with a replay of the Brian Kelly Show Saturday afternoon. Then at 2 o'clock, it's the game day show celebrating its 50th anniversary here on WSBT. Tim Growl and Vince D'Addario, the host, they'll have plenty of guests on board as well. From 4 until 6:30, it's Budweiser's Game Day Sports Beat with Darren Pritchett. And he's also actually got some hockey this Saturday, so Vince will be pitching in a little bit for part of that show as well. 6:30, the Notre Dame Radio Network Tailgate Show. 7:30, kickoff between Notre Dame and Virginia Tech. And then around 11 o'clock, the Notre Dame Football Postgame Show with Evan Sharpley and me. So that is coming up this Saturday night and Saturday afternoon here on WSBT. A timeout, a SportsCenter update is on the way in hour two. We will hit rapid fire with Bobby Hensley and more. That's coming up on Sports Radio 960 AM WSBT.
You're listening to Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat with Sean Stiers on Sports Radio 960 AM WSBT.
It's hour two of Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat, along with Bobby Hensley once again today. Sean Stiers, glad to have you with us. We've got rapid fire coming up in just a little bit. How are you today, Mr. Hensley?
I'm terrific. How are you doing today, Sean?
Fantabulous.
That's great. That's a you making up words again.
I know, right?
Yeah, he'll be in the dictionary someday.
Do what I can. Do what I can.
Fantabulous.
So what'd you think about Jalen Smith getting cut last night? News came out during the middle of the baseball game. Adam Schefter tweets it out. Talked a little bit about it in the first hour. You and I have talked a little bit about him before, so just
I can't remember how much of it's been on the air or off the air, but yeah, the last couple of weeks that's come up quite a bit because you're a Cowboys fan, so
right.
You've seen more of the example, but
and that's what I feel like, and I don't mean this in like any kind of condescending way. I feel like I've got a better grasp on the reality of the whys and hows than like the typical Notre Dame fan who is. People love Jalen Smith. I love Jalen Smith.
Great guy.
Absolutely great guy. It sucks that he got cut by the Dallas Cowboys, especially as someone who covered every snap that he played here at Notre Dame and who watched every snap that he had with the Cowboys. And that's why I feel like I've got kind of a better grasp because I've seen both. I know what he was and how great he was. We all know how devastating the injury was and what it took for him to get back. But his play just hasn't been the same the last few years. That's what it comes down to.
And there's a lot of different angles to look at this from. I think we should start with the positives because he did come back from that injury.
True.
And he played at an all-pro level. And just in general, in the NFL, it's hard to find people that have prolonged careers at any position.
Yeah.
Especially with that kind of injury where he almost lost part of his leg pretty much, you know?
Exactly.
So to come all the way back from that, play at an all-pro level at all, I think is incredible. The fact that the longevity he had, I thought was kind of impressive.
Yeah.
But the lifespan of an average NFL player isn't that long anyway.
It's going to be, I'm really curious to see, I'm guessing he gets a shot with somebody, but like the Cowboys were trying to trade him. Apparently they were trying to trade him even last year before they got all this depth at linebacker with Micah Parsons and the new defensive coordinator. They were trying to draft him last year or trade him last year, and then that didn't happen. And so it's only been a couple years since they gave him the big $65 million contract. And Of course, the irony of that is really when the downhill slide began. He had one really good year, 2018, after a pretty good year, his first year back from the injury in 2017. And then they give him the big contract. And because he was a second-round pick, you've got to do that after 3 years. And so even though he didn't play a year, that still counts,
right,
you know, toward his, you know, whatever.
Terms of service.
Yeah, terms. Yeah, there. That's exactly it, the, you know, his term of service. And so after 3 years, you know, a shorter amount of time, you've got to pay him up, basically. He becomes a free agent sooner. So they give him the big contract. And they paid him a lot. I mean, for an inside linebacker especially, they paid him a lot. And that's – they came to regret it pretty quickly, unfortunately.
Well, and then that's – okay, so I touched on some of the positives, and you you spelled out more of the technical side. But that's what's almost surprising. That's the only part of it that's surprising about the cut, right, is that – they're on the hook for, was it $8 million almost left on the contract?
It's $7.2 million this year.
Yeah.
And so there was no way they could get out of that. They were going to be on the hook for the $7.2 million this year. Ultimately, what they're doing is making sure, like the more he played this year, you know, just kind of like we were talking about with the Broncos-Ravens thing. Mm-hmm. It's football. And on any given play, that can be it. And if he gets injured this year for whatever reason and misses time next year, they'll owe him $9.6 million for next year against the salary cap. So they're basically cutting their losses right now. For a player whose skills have been declining and what they potentially would owe him next year if he were to be hurt again this year.
And I think that makes sense. Again, all the nice things, but in the business side of it, we've talked about this before for other players, but once you see that decline, it's really hard to come out of it, especially at that position. Because his position, you have to be fast, you have to move quick, make snap decisions, and it just
wasn't happening.
And that's
the thing, he's not doing it. Like I talked in the first hour about like guys like Jeremiah Owusu-Koramoah and J.D. Bertrand, right? Two linebackers, for Rover / linebacker, Owusu-Koramoah last year, Bertrand this year. When you see them, they are coming downhill toward the line of scrimmage and making big impact hits, either at, near, or behind the line of scrimmage. That's not what Jalen Smith has done the last couple of years. He is late with his reads at the snap of the football, and you don't see him make a head-on tackle. Everything is either trailing the play or coming from the side of the play. He is never in front of the play making impact at, near, behind the line of scrimmage. Like his tackles for loss, he's only got 20 tackles for loss in his whole NFL career. Owusu-Koramoah himself had 11 last year. So, like, think about that in terms of how
explosiveness.
He is playing.
Yeah,
it's just a lot different. And people talk about his, you know, his drop foot, and I'm sure that that's part of it, for, you know, from the nerve damage. But still, much of it, just watching him, is about the initial read that he is not making at the snap of the football.
And again, even if it is the drop foot, it is then. Like the,
yeah.
Just because the drop foot doesn't mean that the running back should give him another split second.
That's exactly
to try
right. Because people talk about, well, he's a nice guy and you know, he's improved. And that's you and I were talking the other day, and I've kind of used this analogy. Okay, he's improved. All right, it's like saying, well, Joe lost weight. Well, how much weight did Joe lose? Because there's a big difference between 1 or 2 pounds and 30 or 50 pounds, right? So, like, it's all relative.
Sure.
You know, it's so, like, in Jalen Smith's case, he was rated as in the bottom 5% of inside linebackers in the NFL last year by one of these, you know, outside third party, you know, who evaluate all these different guys. Bottom 5%. So, a little bit of improvement is still only, that's not even going to get you, you know, above
obviously
10%.
Not a roster spot.
Yeah, that's right. And that's what it comes down to. You can be the greatest guy in the world, but at the end of the day, you've got to perform on the football field if you want to keep that job in the NFL or any pro sport
and
for that matter.
Being that great of a guy might have got him an extra couple weeks even.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to look at it from that. And then
I think it might have.
You can't, and like the linemen, offensive linemen and the running backs and the quarterbacks, they're all going to be getting younger and more talented every year.
Yeah.
And he's obviously not keeping up with that. And you can't have a guy that every time he makes a tackle, they get 2 or 3 more yards off of the tackle.
And that's the thing, you know, going back to that whole, you know, not coming downhill, most of his tackles start at about 5 yards downfield already.
Yeah.
Like he's not, It's not second and eight. It's second and five, second and four. Those, you know, when he is making tackles on those run plays on first down. The thing I want to say to his credit, but as Darren Pritchett would always remind you, effort is a given. You're always supposed to be, you know, giving full effort on every play. But what he has done, he knows. Because, like if you go back to the Dallas media, you know, he's been called out on this a lot in the last year. And, again, I think people in this area who aren't following the Cowboys, this maybe comes as a surprise because it's like, well, he was just in the Pro Bowl a couple of years ago. What could have happened in that time? Well, you know, his big thing is check the tape. And it's like, well, they did check the tape, and that's not a point in your favor. And so what he's done a lot more of this year, he was doing some of it last year as well, is, I mean, he's going hard to the ball. Whether he's legitimately got a chance to make a play or not, he's going hard to the ball, finding himself around the ball at the end of the step. Sometimes you end up accumulating, you know, maybe an extra half tackle or whatever for getting there. You know, like there was a game, again, like a couple – games ago where there's a pile of five guys around, I think it was the Philly game, and he jumps on top of this pile at the end of the play. And it, you know, and it's like, come on, Jalen. You know, and people kind of deride him for that. Fans especially have been all over him the last couple of years for that kind of stuff. You know, like, that's basically brutal. He's like the Jason Garrett cheerleader kind of guy is what, you know, they're saying about him. Because it's just like, you know, you talk about the leadership and all that kind of stuff. That's unfortunately what it's turned into.
What year was he drafted?
2016.
After
2015
that,
was his, you know, his last season.
And he missed all of 16. So 16, all of 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, yeah. 20. That's a 6-year career, though.
Right.
How many linebackers?
Yeah, when you include that dead year where he didn't get to play.
Which you have to include because his age doesn't take a break.
Right, that's true.
So I get all the criticism and everything. But
yeah, the average NFL lifespan is still like a little over 3 years. And so even to make it six if he doesn't play again is
And that
something.
Linebacker spot's tough because you're hitting hard, you're getting hit hard.
Yeah.
And he was already with that foot and leg injury. Like he was already behind the eight ball. It's a tough situation for the guy. But you got to realize when you think about him at Notre Dame, like a lot of the people in this area are, that was a really long time ago.
Yeah.
15 is his last year playing
when
there?
When you think about it, it's gone pretty quickly, really.
Yeah. Because you just hear the name, and you're like, oh, he's probably doing fine. And that's the other thing is people haven't checked in on him in Dallas, and now all of a sudden, like, whoa. And it's like, well, if you even checked in a little, he's been kind of lower in the standings of inside linebackers in the NFL.
Very unfortunate. But, you know, again, I think you make a good point that it is amazing and a great story just that he got to where he did. At least he got that big payday. That's kind of the solace.
And that's awesome,
Yeah, I mean, because as a guy who had a chance to be the number one overall pick, to have an injury like that, to go in the second round, and I had mixed feelings about, as you know, as much as I, you know, again, follow Notre Dame, like Jalen Smith, fan of the Cowboys. I was mixed about Jerry Jones taking him even in the second round because they took him high in the second round, and they had immediate needs on defense they needed to address. They were, and they've still been really lacking in pass rush, you know, the last few, and that's at that point. So, I mean, like, gosh, it's been 6 years that they've needed to address that, and they've barely addressed it. But, yeah, so even taking that high was a big risk because there were no guarantees that he was going to be able to play again. But
kind of like we said, it's a business. So the fact that it's almost mutual, right? Sucks he got cut, but it's awesome that he got to not beat the system. He earned it.
Yeah.
But to get that contract and get that deal, because he could have never gotten that and really been out.
Yeah. It was really make or break for him this year after they drafted Micah Parsons in the first round, you know, the linebacker from Penn State. They drafted
who's been playing great.
Yeah, he has. And Jabril Cox in the fourth round, another linebacker from LSU. Leighton Vander Esch got healthy. They brought in Keanu Neal from Atlanta. He played with Dan Quinn when he was the head coach there. So it's like they stocked that linebacker room. He had some opportunities, especially because they had to move Parsons to defensive end for a couple games. And it's just – it became pretty apparent. Again, I hear people say – he improved. He just didn't improve enough to keep a roster spot when you've got guys who are able to produce at a higher level.
But so obviously, ultimately, this was a performance thing. There's no off the field issue or anything like that.
No.
And there is a lot of bad NFL football. So I'm sure he'll catch on somewhere.
Yeah.
And, you know, get some snaps in. And if he is improving, which it's hard to believe that he could to the level he was, but he'll get a shot, I think, somewhere. Yeah. Somebody will want him.
I think he will. Like you said, there's a lot of teams that still need to, you know, there were a lot of people saying, oh, we should grab him up and all. And it's like, well.
Check the tape.
Yeah, that's right. Check the tape.
Yeah.
Good. We'll take a timeout. We've got Rapid Fire coming up next with Bobby Hensley, Sean Stiers, Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat on Sports Radio 960 AM WSBT.
Rapid Fire starts now on Sports Radio 960 AM WSBT. And now your host, Sean Stiers.
Along with Bobby Hensley, Rapid Fire on Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat. Couple Notre Dame topics to start us off here tonight. Bobby, fill in the blank. It's blank that Brian Kelly says he's not going to announce his starting quarterback before Saturday's game at Virginia Tech.
I think that's fine because... For one, isn't that how Ian Book got the starting job at one point? Just on a Saturday morning, like randomly before the game, they were like, oh, Ian Book starting instead of, I can't remember who he replaced. Was it Wimbush?
He did replace Wimbush. I'm trying to remember.
It was a road game.
Trying to remember. Yeah, it was at Wake Forest. I'm trying to remember if that's how it happened. I don't.
I think it was that Saturday morning.
I don't remember that detail.
Because
but
I remember I was watching game day. And
it's
like
funny how things
him.
Just blur together over the years. Yeah. It's like, I was there, but
So I think it's. Totally fine. Plus, Brian Kelly, he's been playing all the quarterbacks. So to even have a starter is almost, I don't know if it matters that much. I don't think there's a huge difference between first and third right now.
I agree. Well, I think I think the top two guys, there's a difference between them and
just the
and
styles,
Buckner,
yeah.
The three guy. Yeah, it's because obviously they don't trust Buckner enough for him to be running the regular offense in the past. Not that they don't trust him. He hasn't learned enough yet. He hasn't been around long enough yet to learn everything. But, yeah, I think it's Kelly's prerogative. He doesn't want to announce it publicly. He doesn't have to announce it. But like you said, and Justin Puente, the Virginia Tech coach, said as much, I'm preparing for all three quarterbacks. I mean, they just played all three quarterbacks last week.
Right, that's what I'm saying. They're all going to get reps.
So you've got to prepare for all of them. Because you just don't know. So, and Kelly said that it's not a competitive advantage thing. So that's, I guess, if it's not a competitive advantage thing,
you're confused.
Then what's the downside to just announcing it and letting everybody know?
Because he said he knows, he just doesn't want to announce it.
Yeah.
Or do you think he just really actually doesn't know? I don't know. I think what's funny is in this kind of situation, I think that we're getting closer and closer to there being a rule about. Announcing a starter because of all the gambling and stuff that goes on.
That's a good point. Like, I don't know who would regulate that. Typically, I would think that would be regulated by the conferences because I don't think it's something the NCAA can touch.
They don't want
it. Yeah, they're hands off with gambling. But, I mean, that's a good point. Like, a couple of weeks ago in the Wisconsin game, for example, it was one of the first games I remember seeing it on FanDuel, and some other sites had it as well, some sports books. They had player props in there, you know, like Jack Cohn over-under passing yards.
Or touchdowns.
And Graham Mertz. And, yeah, all that different stuff. Kyron Williams, Chris Tyree, Michael Mayer, all these different guys, they were doing individual props in there. So I wonder if that does reach college sports.
Obviously, that's a bigger issue than why Kelly hasn't announced a starting quarterback.
Yeah, exactly.
But that was one of the first things I thought, because I could change a game line even or – you know, money line, over-unders, all those kind of things.
It's been a weird week anyway.
Yeah.
I almost feel like, I don't know if he's just, I definitely feel like, and I didn't think about this until after the fact, I think he's always going to be a little salty after a loss, and it's typically immediacy, like right after the loss, but Monday, you know, he got a little bit salty with a couple of the guys, but it can't. I just feel like because of who he lost to, it was Cincinnati.
Personal.
And we talked about all that stuff. Yeah, it's a little more personal, maybe. So maybe, you know, it's, you know, what do you do when you're a coach and there's things that you can't control? Well, you turn and you control as many other things that you have under your control. So is it just a control issue?
Well, and losing in general is not fun. And you're
top
10
agree.
Team. And so, and they haven't lost that much in the last several years. So it's kind of a new thing. You know, this group hadn't lost, obviously. So.
They hadn't lost a regular season game in almost two calendar years.
And when the last time they lost at home?
That's exactly right. So 2017, it had been 4 years since they had lost at home. So a lot of things happened in that one game. And again, I mean, we were talking about it yesterday, the fact that he just passed Newt Rockne against Wisconsin, and then who's the team he has to face in his next game at home? The team that he coached before he came here, and we obviously found out that all those Cincinnati fans still bear, you know, some pretty bad feelings toward Brian Kelly, and they let him hear it and all that kind of stuff. And then they win to go along with it. I mean, you talk about just mounds of salt in the wound.
I don't understand all of it. I understand some of it. Even the day of, I understand. Mm-hmm. But they were the underdog at home, Notre Dame.
Yeah.
Cincinnati was a higher-ranked team.
Yeah.
So it shouldn't have lingered that long, you wouldn't think. But, like, to bring out walk-ons for media availability.
And that's what I was going to say, too. And, you know, then that happens last night when they were supposed to have Chris Tyree, who's not technically a starter, but a significant guy.
He's playmaker.
Yeah, plus three other, you know. But he was in there because he's from Virginia and the Virginia connection. They're going to Virginia Tech, so he was in there. And still a prominent player. And then three other starters, but then it turns into Chris Tyree and four walk-ons at the media.
That
at
weren't
the
even
last
announced.
Minute. At the last minute.
Not even time to prep for him or anything.
Yeah, so that's – you can't tell me there's a coincidence, because supposedly the players voted on it, and that's who they were going to send out. So you're going to send out Chris Tyree still, and yeah. Then four walk-ons. Okay.
Yeah, why even send Tyree out there then?
Yeah, are you telling me that it gets put to a vote every week who they're going to send out there?
Yeah.
I strongly doubt that.
Yeah, so I guess it's not gamesmanship not announcing your starting quarterback, but everything else kind of seems like you're almost frazzled, or salty's one word, frazzled or shaken maybe. I don't know. But it's not like they were, like I said, they weren't putting people away. They weren't dominating victories. I mean, the Wisconsin game, the score looked like it, but it was a battle.
Yeah.
So I don't understand the whole how one loss, now everything's in peril and everything's question marks. And it just seems like he's trying to do a different tactic and change it up in the middle of the season, which makes no sense.
And the whole, like, he made the comment himself about the quarterbacks after the game about, we can't keep doing this flavor of the week, is what he called it. Well, I mean, there wasn't a flavor of the week. You know, I think where it really got muddled, I think it became apparent that they needed to make the move to Drew Pine, and they made the move to Drew Pine. Where it got muddled was continuing to insert Tyler Buchner after the fact. Like, they stuck him in the middle of the drive right after Pine had kind of gotten into a little bit of a groove. He hits Michael Mayer for a nice gain. He hits Kevin Austin for Austin's first completion of the game. And then, boom, here comes Tyler Buchner for one play. And then he runs off the field, and they end up punting.
And that's why I don't understand what that flavor of the week comment, because Kelly's used multiple quarterbacks most of his time at Notre Dame.
Yeah.
Like, even when Everett Golson's
just
there,
like you said, that's how
Tommy
Ian
Reese
came
would
to
come
be.
In and yeah. close out the games. And they're different styles even, but he always had both of them getting snaps, mm-hmm. and staying in the mix. And, you know, Malik Zaire, Wimbush, they all were playing at the same time at some point.
Yeah.
In switching quarterbacks. So I don't understand that flavor of the week comment at
all. I don't get it either. I don't get it. Because if it is a flavor of the week, it's by his own doing.
Right.
So
yeah, who's the one putting him in?
Yeah. So who do you think it's going to be? Who do you think is going to start?
I think it's Drew Pine, because if it was going to still be Jack Cohn, they just would have said Jack Cohn.
He would have just said Jack Cohn.
That's an easy layup, just to say, oh, we're starting Jack Cohn, and then pull him after a drive even.
Yeah,
you know, if you wanted to. So I think it has to be Drew Pine. Plus, the momentum's on his side.
Yeah, and again,
he's looked better. The eye test.
They always release the depth chart before his press conference on Monday. And the press conference is obviously at noon. Then during the press conference is when he said, well, we're not going to announce it. I'm going to talk to the players. So Jack Cohn was still number one on the depth chart. There's nothing to read into that simply because he said that they weren't going to announce it publicly. So that means they're just going to show you what they already had last week, you know. So
right. It's just duping in for whatever.
Yeah, depth charts are always subject to change no matter
what. Right. So. But I think even if you start Jack Cohn, who says the second drive isn't Drew Pine.
Oh, man.
Well, if it's a pick in the end zone.
Then you are flavor of the week.
I don't know. I could just see him switching again.
Okay, so Kelly also says criticism of his offensive line coach, Jeff Quinn, is, quote, totally unfair, unquote. Do you buy or sell that?
I sell. And the part of it that makes me sell it is that totally. Because there's going to be criticism. The unit's playing poorly. I don't know if the offensive line coach is fair to, you know, completely blame him, because some of it's probably the kids, some of it's, you know, the schemes maybe. I don't know. It's a mix of everything. But They're all unproven. It's not like he brought in a unit of five guys that were there last year that were dominant.
Right.
So I don't think it's totally fair to blame him. But obviously he takes some of it. And you have to. That's what your job is, especially at the college level. You're the face of it. Don't go after the kids.
But you have a boss at work, right? Like you have you have someone at the very top, and then you have like an intermediary or two at different levels who are all in charge of you in the chain of command. Everyone has someone they have to answer to, right? So if you have a group that's underperforming, the person in charge of that group is the one who has to answer to it, right?
With great power comes great responsibility.
That's right. And it's the same with Brian Kelly. You've got the position coach. You've got the coordinator, you know, offensive coordinator. You've got the head coach. The offensive line coach is the person most directly responsible for the group that is most underperforming on this team right now. They're 80 rushing yards per game, ranks 124th in the nation. Only six teams in the whole country are worse than them right now. And they have the same running back who ran for 1,125 yards and 5.3 per carry last year. So that variable hasn't changed. Now, like you said, now you've got different guys moving in there, but it's still, you've got a sixth-year guy who came over from Marshall who was supposed to be an All-American who performing just like the other guys who have less experience.
And that's what I maybe I went a little too harsh. I'm not saying that he doesn't get blame. I'm just saying that totally blame him.
Right.
Totally. It's just,
I don't know who else, but then who else do you put it on though? Who else can you put it on? Because it's like Brian Kelly, when he talks about the performance of the line, he really mostly talks about pass protection. And they've given up 22 sacks, and the 22 sacks rank 127th in the nation. Only Southern Miss and Akron are worse than them giving up sacks right now. Okay, so yeah, there are other position groups, tight ends and running backs, who factor in pass protection. But again, like, just look at the rushing stat. They ran for over 200 yards a game last year. They're at 80 yards right now. That's on the offensive line.
Absolutely. I think it's kind of surprising, too, because sometimes you see this where the coach kind of shies away from it, almost to, like, put it on the offensive line coach, per se, in this situation.
Yeah.
Put it on him so that at the end of the year or partway through the season, you can let him go and save your own hide.
That's true.
So it's kind of surprising that he's defending him so much on something that's clearly very bad. And what you bring up is so true. It's not just that they're terrible at run blocking or pass blocking. It's both. It's all of it.
It's just all of the above.
People are just getting through and doing whatever they want against
them. Because at least a couple years ago in 2019, with a group of guys who ended up, you know, turning into NFL guys last year, at least then they weren't very good run blockers, but they were pretty good in pass protection. Right. Now they're not doing anything well. And now, granted,
the quarterback's the one thing,
well, it's a different quarterback, less mobile quarterback, and the fact that they've had to use four left tackles already. Okay, yeah, that factors in. But again, the fact that you've had to bring in other position groups, more tight ends on the field, two running backs on the field to help make up for what's lacking in pass protection, that alone says you're covering for the offensive line. And again, it is
and
the position coach's responsibility.
Yeah, not to beat a dead horse here, but like they also haven't had the toughest schedule this year so far.
Yeah.
So it's not like, you know, you played Alabama and a couple SEC schools and Clemson and
every
they're beating
team,
up on you.
Every team that has played Notre Dame, I think with the exception of Cincinnati last week, has had more sacks than their average going into the game.
And Cincinnati won anyway. So
yeah,
that's
Cincinnati
not a good,
still won. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, I think it's nonsense to say anything other than it is fair. But I understand he's not throwing his guy under the bus, like you said. There's a case to be made that he should, not necessarily throws him under the bus, but, you know, kind of lights a fire under his butt, you know, so to speak, maybe to that kind of thing.
I just don't know how you can change at this point in the season, though. What are you going to do?
Yeah,
change
what,
your blocking
where are you going to shift? Yeah. That's the thing. Where do you go to next if you did make some kind of change midseason? That's the thing. Because all you've got basically is a grad assistant on staff, and then you've got other guys who are supposed to be, you know, coaching the offensive line. All right, we will take a timeout when we come back. More Rapid Fire with Bobby Hensley. Sean Steyer's on Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat, Sports Radio 960 WSBT. Budweiser's weekday sports beat and rapid fire continue on Sports Radio 960 AM WSBT with Bobby Hensley, Sean Stiers. Fill in the blank. Last night's Red Sox-Yankees AL wildcard game was blank.
Disappointing. I wanted a better baseball game.
Yeah.
It was 6-1, and when the Yankees got thrown out at home, you kind of felt that it was 3-1 at that point. That would have made it 3-2. You kind of felt like they lost any momentum they had, and that was kind of their last shot.
As an anti-Yankee for my life,
you loved it.
I was not disappointed at all. I think, you know, you can like or dislike either one of those teams. The biggest thing that stood out to me was just the electricity and the environment. Flipping on the TV, and I turned it on a little bit late, the crowd was already into it. And, like, playoff baseball, you already have a different atmosphere at a game.
So tense. Every pitch matters.
That's right. And, like, Yankee Stadium and Fenway Park are going to always give you two of the better environments anyway.
Yeah,
that's exactly right. Just because it's, like, baseball central out there. But the crowd noise, Fenway Park is rowdy, and we didn't get that last year. Like, it's been almost 2 years since we had that kind of environment for a baseball game. Because, again, playoff baseball is always different anyway, but, like, it's been since the end of the Nationals-Astros World Series a couple years ago that we had that kind of crowd environment because COVID last year.
Last year didn't have any.
Yeah, you had no crowds, and so you had piped-in crowd noise on the TV and fake fans and all that different kind of stuff. So I thought it was just really cool. Like, you said this yesterday. You couldn't have asked for a better matchup and probably the right stadium to have it at as well, Fenway Park, because those people are just nuts anytime the Yankee, you know, they're nuts anyway, but then the Yankees come in and they're even more nuts. But you couldn't have asked for anything better maybe than a little bit closer game. How about Nate Eovaldi outpitching
lights
Garrett
out.
Cole, though?
He was lights
Man.
Out. Yeah, it's like Chris Sale, who?
Yeah.
They don't even, obviously he couldn't pitch yesterday. But
it's that's
like,
why they kept Eovaldi around. The guys had injuries, but, you know, a few years ago, when I guess it's
Tommy
been
Johns.
3 years ago now, they got him, and he was a big World Series hero when they beat the Dodgers in the World Series. And that's why they kept him around, you know, so they kind of honored that. And he's had two Tommy Johns, like you said, but he was great last night. He was lights out.
The Red Sox narrative has changed a lot in my mind because you talk about being an anti-Yankee guy. I'm not anti-Red Sox, but the Red Sox won. It was 88 years in 2004 when they won the World Series.
Now they've won four in
17. Well, so that's part of it. That whole region is dripping in championships, obviously.
Yeah.
But then also,
yeah, that's true, too. I didn't even think about that because even all their pro sports teams have won championships since 2004.
Right.
Yeah, hockey,
multiple,
basketball,
even. Yeah.
And, yeah, the Patriots, obviously.
And then 2005, the White Sox won it, and it was a 92-year curse, whatever, drought. That's the word I'm looking for. And nobody cared that it was 92 years. And I know the White Sox are not even the biggest team in their own city. But it's like, come on. The Red Sox, 88 years was such a big deal.
Yeah.
Making history, all this. And then the Sox win it the next year, 92
because
years.
Because it was Red Sox fans.
And nobody cared. So ever since and then the Red Sox have gone on to win more. And perennial contender, last year excluded.
Yeah.
But it's like, okay. So I'm just, the narrative of the Red Sox being the historic underdog is gone.
Well,
so they're almost on par with the Yankees at this point my generation.
I'm not saying they don't go out and make free agent moves, but I've been – this is something else I was thinking about. I've been pretty impressed the way they have scouted and drafted and restocked. Now, you know, they got Verdugo as part of the Mookie Betts deal and all that kind of stuff, but you had to give up Mookie Betts to get him.
Which is a bigger piece than,
think of their outfield just 3 years ago. It was Betts, Benintendi, and Jackie Bradley Jr. None of those guys are there now, and they're back in the playoffs again.
And J.D. Martinez isn't even playing.
Yeah, that's crazy. And he's been their best offensive guy the last 3 years.
Yeah. So I'm not anti either of them. I was just cheering for a good game. And I didn't get that. And then it's like, all right, so now are the Red Sox favorited against Tampa Bay in the next series? They could be.
Could be, but I'd put my money on Tampa.
Well, if Eovaldi pitches like he does.
But that'll be like, what, game three at the earliest at this point. So.
Well, in Tampa, they were, up there in runs scored and ERA, so that's a tough matchup for anybody.
Always, yep. Fill in the blank on another one. Alex Rodriguez is blank as a baseball analyst.
He's okay. You love him. No, you hate the Yankees, so you hate him. I think
not just that I hate the Yankees. He's just horrible.
I think it's okay because he's A-Rod, so he is something. But it's not like Tony Romo where the guy came straight from the game to – and I'm not digging on you because I like Tony Romo.
Okay.
That's what I'm saying. He's fun to listen to. You just hear his enthusiasm for the game and the way he calls it.
Right.
Tony Romo. And he's laughing. He's enjoying it. And, like, it just seems like he's a little kid calling a game.
A-Rod is just like you want a guy – like when Kruk was in there, for example. You want a guy that you feel like you could be hanging out with at the bar and having these baseball conversations with. That ain't A-Rod.
And then A-Rod
is A-Rod is making these
– top.
And he's decent in the studio, but as a game analyst, he is bad. Like, did you hear last night? He was like, oh, Yankees fans, don't worry about – Gerrit Cole, he'll have a better second season in the Bronx next year. He'll win a Cy Young. Well, this is already his second season.
Yeah. Well, the way he said it was even worse than that because he said, don't worry about Gerrit Cole. I guarantee Cy Young Award winner next year. The second year in New York's always easier. And you saw how he did better this year in New York than last year.
Well, And then he said, he told Yankees and Red Sox not to bother being smart. They just need to keep their superpowers, which is basically tremendous resources. So, in other words, don't worry about making smart moves. Just go out and spend more money.
Like
because
you did
got
on
it.
Me.
Yeah, that's exactly. Yeah. Spoken like a guy they overpaid for.
And he's like talking down to people the whole game. And I feel like he was trying too hard to inflect himself to be that guy you could just sit and have a conversation with.
That's a good point. I think that's who he thinks he is, but he's not even close. And that's the problem. I think he's there especially because when they hired him to that booth, he was still with J-Lo.
I was just going to say the J-Lo.
And they were bringing in J-Lo all the time. I think they like him because he's a celebrity. And it's like, you know, they used to do it like with the College World Series. They would have the analysts who had some kind of college tie, but they weren't necessarily into college baseball. But it's just, like Oral Hershiser they would bring. Now, Oral was good because he's Oral Hershiser. He could talk about pitching on any level. But they would bring in these guys who didn't really know that much about the college game just because they were name guys who had a college background with them.
Right.
And I think that, they've done better there since they brought in more guys who actually follow the college game, whether they're big names or not. So
the baseball one for the World Series is – it's turning into like what all the NFL shows are. If it's like, oh, you used to play? We'll get you in the booth or get you on the pregame or our panel or our whatever, our desk. So now all of a sudden you have eight guys on a desk talking over each other the whole time.
Yeah, exactly.
So I understand they had to pull someone, but I don't know. Like, it seems like Frank Thomas would have been a better fit, or like even Ortiz might have been more personality in the booth or have A-Rod and Ortiz. So you have a Red Sox and a Yankee.
That'd be awesome, actually.
Yeah. And put him on a secondary stream or something.
I don't know. Like, Kruk was always good, and it seemed like he was one of the first to go. And I don't know if it was a contract disagreement. Or I think he's, doing radio for the Giants or something like that now.
With John Miller?
But he had such a cool personality. And, again, it's like that's the guy that you could sit and listen to. Because he might say something kind of goofy, but at the end of the day, he knows his baseball, and he can communicate it.
Right.
So, just much better.
And they did have a secondary stream called StatCast that was kind of entertaining to listen to.
Yeah.
The White Sox announcer, Benetti, was on it, and that's what made me try it out. Yep. But
all right, last thing tonight. I want to get this in
because
it's kind of been out there for a little bit. Sylvester Stallone's going to release a director's cut of Rocky IV. It's going to include 40 minutes of never-before-seen footage, including footage of Rocky's trainer, Mickey.
Oh, boy.
He's going to release it in theaters November 11th. Scale of 1 to 10, how must-see is the director's cut of Rocky IV?
I'll give it an 8, and here's why. You said it's in theaters, and it's coming out late November, to late November?
They're going to do it in theaters, a one-night like theatrical release, where apparently there's going to be some kind of Q&A that he's going to be doing live during this.
Huh.
But so that'll be the 11th, and then the next day they're releasing it digitally.
I think it'd be really awesome to see, because especially somebody my age, I did not get the chance to see any of the Rockies in theater.
Because this is like, to you, this is like the original Rocky. You're so young.
Yeah.
Did you say this is the first Rocky you actually saw?
Yeah, and I'm 35 now, and it still sticks out. Yeah. Like, when you think of Rockies.
This one made the most of any. Apparently, until The Blind Side, Rocky IV was the top grossing sports movie ever.
That's wild. And then I think, plus the time of year, it'll get you in the Christmas spirit, the holiday mood, it's fall, and that was obviously set in the winter.
Here's the thing about these directed cut, director cut, extended. The original was like an hour and a half. That's a pretty tight, streamlined movie right there, especially for as much action as in it. You always see, like, if you get the DVD, you know, there's not as many DVDs sold now, but like when they used to do DVDs and you get the DVD extras, the deleted scenes. Deleted scenes, there's a reason they're deleted scenes, you know? So, I know, apparently it's got, you know, like a flashback of Mickey calling him an SOB, you know, and it's, you know, it's that kind of stuff, obviously, since he died in Rocky III. So I don't know how much I need it, but I'm a big fan of the franchise, so I'd be with you. I'd probably be around an 8.
But that's exactly it. You said you're a big fan of the franchise. So if you're not going into that wondering what kind of movie it is or how it's going to be, because it's so...
And it's been a while since I've seen Rocky IV.
So that's what I mean. You're not going into that waiting to like see how it turns out or you know what to expect. So if it's a little bit longer, you get a couple extra scenes and you're a super fan, then that's very rewarding for you.
That's exactly
right. I don't know how much the Q&A adds, though.
Yeah.
Nah, you can leave then. Beat the traffic.
I'll be curious. I saw something else that's going to be in there. I can't remember. Can I find it here real quick? Oh, they're taking out. You remember... Paulie's robot in Rocky IV. They're taking out the robot. They took that out because there was apparently some tech company back then, and this is the 80s. There was some tech company, I think, that paid to have that in or something. So they're taking out Paulie's dumb little robot waiter. It was a waiter. So, yeah.
Before its time.
That's right. Bobby, good stuff as always. I'll talk to you next week.
Sure thing, Mick.
You're going to get
it. Okay.
All right. Budweiser's weekday sports beat is brought to you by Budweiser, the king of beers, locally distributed by United Beverage Company of South Bend. Football fans, this Bud's for you. Food Bank of Northern Indiana, Tim Grau State Farm Insurance, Midland Engineering Company, the Mishawaka Education Foundation, Barnaby's of Mishawaka and Granger, Fisher's Barbecue and Catering, South Bend Orthopedics, Wings Etc. Grill and Pub, Four Winds Casino, and Mimo's Pizza on Edison in Mishawaka. Oh, and Legacy Heating and Air. We've got the Money Line with Jim Irizarry coming up next on Sports Radio 960 AM WSBT.